because I won't tell the whole story now for those of you who've heard it a number of times. When I was 18, I prayed a prayer that was really close to that song. I was on a hilltop in El Paso, Texas, and had just had this powerful experience. We were serving people in Juarez, Mexico. And on that hilltop, I made this prayer with God, kind of this pact to say, all right, God, whatever you say for me to do, I'll try my best to do it. Wherever you call me to go, I'll do my best to follow you. And I've tried to be faithful to that. And it gets hard sometimes. It gets very hard sometimes. And when it started to become clear that what God was asking our family to do is to start a brand new church, to leave an established church and to start something new, initially, we were not excited about that. And there's a lot of reasons why, but here's one of them. I don't know if I've talked about this much. One of the reasons why it was hard for us was our impression of what we thought we had to do. And I remember before we even said, okay, we'll do this new church thing, they flew us out to this conference. The Covenant Denomination flew us out to this conference, Laura and I, and they were teaching us, so here's how you would do it if you're going to do it. Here's how to do it. And there's this guy that got up, and he was saying, well, you know, one of the things that's really important is when you get started, you got to start with some people, and you got to gather these people. So he's all, you got to carry your card with you everywhere you go. And when you get your hair cut, you got to pop that card out there. And when you go to Starbucks, you got to get that card in people's hands. And he's all, you know, and I'm all, I mean, I don't know about you guys. I usually run from people who are all, you know, like this. And so that was tough for us. But what we're learning is that it doesn't need to be like that. In fact, I would argue it shouldn't, in the sense of you're being intrusive. God's given some people just the outgoing personalities, and some of you it's just much easier for you to approach people and all that. But it can be much much more natural than that. I want to tell you guys a cool true story. I want to tell you a cool one. Some of you who get the ECC mail, we call it, that little email that goes out that you can sign up for. I've told this there, but it's going to be new to a number of you. Okay, so here's the story. I had this meeting at Caribou, and if some of you know the area, it's the, let's see, I'm kind of mixed up my directions, probably that way. The Caribou by the Shoreview Super Target, the one by Devani, some of you might know this. Well, that place. So I'm having this meeting there. And while I'm having this meeting, I noticed that, in fact, Linda's here. Linda Johnson was there with her daughter, Greta. Where am I missing you? Where, oh, you're right there. Okay. So I see her there with her daughter. And so I wrap up this meeting and I go up to talk to Linda. And so you're here to validate whether or not I'm exaggerating, because pastors sometimes do that. Well, anyway, so I go up and we're having this conversation, and it was great because they were very excited about how things were going. We'd had maybe one or two services, and they were really excited, and that brought me a lot of joy, because we don't want to be just a single kind of church, like only families with kids like it or only young adults like it. We want to try to be a church that a mom and her adult daughter can feel great about coming. So we're having this discussion. And while we're having this discussion, there's this person who hears us talking. And that some person is here today too. Faith, can you kind of work your way up? All right, I asked Faith if she would come up and just kind of tell what was going on from her side of things. This is Faith. Everybody say hi, Faith. Hi. All right. So Faith, if you can just, in your own words, yeah, why don't you come over here. In your own words, if you can tell us, when you heard this conversation, here, if you want to hold it, you can. Okay. Just tell us what was going through your head when you heard kind of the conversation.
Well, I was at Caribou to study biochemistry, and if any of you have taken a chemistry class, it's not that interesting, no matter what the professors tell you. And I overhear this guy, and he's like, and the book of Ezekiel and John, and, you know, they say, pastor, you know, understatement. Yeah, that was an understatement about how excited they were. I mean, they were going off about this, and I'm sitting there, and I'm trying not to listen, because, you know, eavesdropping is not polite, and so I go through, and they are just so excited about this church. And I moved here about a year and a half ago, and with my fiance, who's out here for vet school, and we have been looking for a church. Okay, I have been looking for a church and trying to get Corey to come with me, and it hasn't been that easy of a task. And so I hear these people, and they're talking, and they're just so excited about that. I'm like, okay, I'm not going to ask. And then finally, I just couldn't help it. So I walked up, and here's Pastor Chris, and I'm like, I'm sorry, I have to ask, what church do you guys go to? Like, where is this coming from? Why are you so excited about church? This is awesome. And they're like, whoa, well, it's ECC. And he pulls out his card. And so
I learned a lesson.
I chat with them and Lynn and Greta, and I go about studying biochemistry very hesitantly. And I go home and I talk to my friends. I'm like, I met this guy at Caribou Coffee and I got his card. And he's like, okay. I'm like, he's a pastor at this church. And he's like, okay. I'm like, well, we need to go. I'm like, I just think this would be really cool. He's a really great guy. I think you guys would click really well. And he's like, okay. I'm like, we meet every 3 weeks. Oh, okay.
In fact, Corey, why don't you make your way on up since we've already started talking about you. This is Corey. This is the fiance. Why don't you come on up? Okay, so you can just hold the mic here for a second. So she goes home and starts talking with Corey. And Corey, so what's going on in your head while all this is going on?
For me, it was one of those, oh goody, another church to try. Yay. I get to go sit down and go, well, they're going on and preaching and telling me how I'm a bad person and I'm never going to make it to heaven. And everything that I ever learned was wrong. They're the only ones that are right. It's what I was expecting. So it's just like, goody, another one. All right, I'm going to make her happy, and I'm going to go. And we were having a lot of problems. I was having a lot of issues with school life and home life. And because I'm in vet school, I don't have time for any other life, so that's pretty much all of it. So it was – we needed something else anyway. It's like, all right, well, we'll go. We'll see how it is. And we come here, and it's out of school. And we're going – all right, right there, I kind of like this because it's not the normal. It's not the normal brick and mortar type of structure. So it felt a little bit more comfortable for me. And then going through it, I'm sitting here and I'm waiting for everything that I normally hate about church to happen. I'm like, okay, I have my checklist out. What's going to happen? What's going to happen next? What's going to happen that I hate? And it turns out that I didn't hate it at all. I really enjoyed it. The songs and the messages and everything were very laid back and very comfortable, and it was the second service that you have that we made it to.
Oh, okay.
So it was the message is good. The seeds are sometimes hard to swallow, yeah. And it was perfect for the time where we were and where I was, and so now it's our home.
Cool. Well, can you guys give these guys a big hand for coming up and thanks you guys. Thanks. You already answered all the questions I had. Good job. So you know. As we do, we try to be intentional here about what we do. And when we give you a chance to try to, you know, meet people, please seize those opportunities because there's people, everyone's got a story, you know, and we want to try to get to know each other. But there's a number of reasons why I asked if they would be willing to come up and share. And the first one is there are people who are looking for a church like this. I've been doing my best to try to get around to you know, other churches and it's a unique one. Of course, we have things in common with others, but God would not have called us to start a brand new church if there weren't unique things he wanted to do. So there are people that are looking for it, and you don't have to be all, you know. When I handed you the card, it was actually something she wanted, not something like, okay, I'll take this so you'll get off my back. And then there was something that had the information. So I would encourage you to just, if you're not already, carry a couple of those around, and if God ever steers the conversation that way, or if you feel like it would be something helpful, you've got some information to hand out. Because we don't want to be the space invaders. We don't want to be the ones who are just badgering and badgering. Unless you're feeling that is a God-given strategy, which might be the case. Some people need it. But for the most part, we want to try to just be people who are just natural. So that's one of the reasons we steer it that way. But the other reason I wanted to tell that story today was because we're going to be talking about the Spirit of God. And it was interesting how God's Spirit was in this situation already at work setting things up. And that is the case all the time. We just don't recognize it. He had all the pieces were in place there at Caribou. You know, I had this meeting there and there was a conversation, but we each had our part too in it. Even though God had set up the pieces, we each had a part to play. My part was to go up and say hi to Linda and Greta, and their part was just to have a natural conversation. We didn't strategize. All right, let's talk really loud so people overhear us and come to our church. It wasn't like that. And then their part was just to be honest and to talk openly. And then Faith had a part that was to step out of her comfort zone and say, can you tell me more about this? And she had another part to tell Corey. And Corey had a part, okay, I'll give it a chance. You know, we all had a part to play. God set it up, but we all had a part. So what I want to do now is I want to take us through a biblical story where the Spirit is at work. And I am really looking forward to this. It is an old one. It comes out of the Old Testament section of the Bible. It's, you know, people disagree as far as exactly how old it is, as far as when the author wrote it. But it could be as old as 2,500 years old. But yet I think you're going to find as we read through this, it has a lot to say to us today. We're going to look, and we're going to be looking for the Spirit. Now, if you're a regular, you might have noticed, if you went for the note pages, you might be going, where's the blanks? I normally fill in the blanks, and where are the quotes? This is a little bit different, and it's good. I hope we don't have like a same Sunday rut that we fall into. I hope we don't always just do things identical. And what we're going to do today, the reason it's blank is we're just going to walk through the story of Esther, and see how God's Spirit is at work. We'll have some commentary along the way, but we'll mostly be just looking at the story. And one of the things I find fascinating about the story is that it's a true one. This isn't one of these situations. We've been focusing on a parable the last couple weeks where Jesus was telling this fictional story to prove a point. This one is history. So this is exciting. Now, I mentioned this last time we were together. There's the Bible has a number of different books. And different books serve different purposes. And we could, looking at the Spirit, we could go to the book of Acts, where you've got spirits all over the place, and they're very visible. But like I mentioned last time, that'd be like hunting cows. It would just be too easy. So what we're going to do is we're going to go to a book of the Bible that doesn't even mention God by name. A book of the Bible, in fact, the only one, I think, that doesn't mention God by name, doesn't specifically mention prayer, worship, some of these things that we'd expect to find in a biblical book, it doesn't mention them. And what I would put out there before you is if we can see the Spirit of God at work in a book that has a very secular feel, I hope would be we could see the Spirit of God at work in our own lives. So we're going to take a look. I think this is going to be fun. All right, if you did bring a Bible and you want to open it up, we're looking at the book of Esther, verse 1, chapter 1. Here we go. Here's how it starts out. This is what happened during the time of Xerxes, the Xerxes who ruled over 127 provinces stretching from India to Kush. All right, well, this is an interesting way to frame the opening scene. Because if you read the rest of the Bible, God doesn't like to share his glory with anyone else. He makes that clear. Well, why would the Spirit of God inspire then to say this is the time of Xerxes instead of this is God's time, Xerxes happens to just, you know, be in there? Well, after studying this book, I think this is sarcastic irony. I think this is all intentional because Xerxes is not in control. He thinks he is. He really thinks he is. Who is this Xerxes, by the way, that we speak of? Well, Xerxes, if you read in your English Bible, the Xerxes that we see spelled out is a transliteration of the Greek form of a Persian name from a Hebrew text. That's where we get our Xerxes. So I can see why there's confusion and why some people say, no, this is not the Xerxes that we know from history, but I disagree. I think it is. Because I think it not only fits the timeline, we're going to look at that, but I think it fits the character. If you take the other historical books and you put them next to the book of Esther, I think it all lines up. I think it all lines up perfectly. Well, this is the time of Xerxes, or so he thought. Xerxes, now, you can read about this outside the Bible. He was about to fulfill his destiny. The city-state of Athens, they had humiliated his father in battle. They had just humiliated the Persians, this empire. And so now Xerxes comes to the throne, and it is his time for payback. The year was either 484 BC or 483 BC when we open up the book of Esther. And he is gearing up for war against the Greeks. Xerxes is mobilizing. I mean, he is mobilizing. They are cutting a pass through the mountains for their army. And they're taking this serious. They are building a bridge across the strait that separates the Black Sea and the Mediterranean. It's called the Hellespont. I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right. They're building a bridge across an ocean strait. I mean, he's serious about this, all right? Well, if you've seen the movie or heard of the movie 300, this is the same Xerxes. This is the guy. This is the same one. He's a man of enormous wealth, of unquestioned power. And what movie is what battle is the movie 300 based on? You shout it out. Thermopylae. Okay, very good. So the book of Esther opens on the eve of this battle. not like the day before Eve, but right before this battle. And in this, in the opening, Xerxes is in his citadel, it's called, his citadel at Susa. They had a number of different capitals, and one of them was Susa. The one you might know best is Babylon, but he's at Susa right now, and he's got this citadel. It's like this fortress castle in the middle of this city. And so he's there, and he is gearing up for war, and so he has this huge banquet. If you got your Bibles, we're going to look at verses 4 through 8. We'll also put them up on the screen. All right, listen to this. Now, this is what I call gearing up, all right? For a full 180 days, Xerxes displayed the vast wealth of his kingdom and the splendor and glory of his majesty. When these days were over, the king gave a banquet lasting 7 days in the enclosed garden of the king's palace. Listen to this banquet. For all the people, from the least to the greatest, who were in the citadel of Susa, the garden and had hangings of white and blue linen, fastened with cords of white linen and purple material to cover silver rings on marble pillars. There were couches of gold and silver on a mosaic pavement of something, marble and mother of pearl and other costly stones. Wine was served in goblets of gold, get this, each one different from the other. Wow. And the royal wine was abundant in keeping with the king's liberality. By the king's command, each guest was allowed to drink with no restrictions, for the king instructed all the wine stewards to serve each man what he wished. All right, so that's the banquet. That's the banquet. Well, while the king's banquet, I should say this too. It's interesting as you read other history outside the Bible that they used to do this. They used to, when they were going to go to war, they'd want to puff everybody up, you know, so they'd want to have this banquet to show a powerful air. It's kind of like a turkey, the human male equivalent of a turkey or a peacock getting all fluffed up, you know, to say, oh, check me out. So that's what's going on. And it's good to do a saturation reading of the book of Esther, which I did because I started to catch these contrasts. All right, we just looked at the king's banquet. Now look at the queen's banquet. Take a look at this. This is the whole thing. Queen Vashti also gave a banquet. It was nice. That's it. You know, anyone else see a contrast? All right. I do. And here's another contrast I noticed. If you leave that up, look at this. Not only was the banquet apparently a much more simple, what does it say about the palace? Whose palace is it? King Xerxes. She's the queen, right? You're going to, as we look at this Xerxes guy, this was his time. It was not the palace of the royal family. It was the king's palace. In fact, when you look at how his queens refer to him, they don't call him hubby or schnooky yookums or anything like that. It's king. He's king. Well, after 187 days of partying, the king, he's all liquored up, he's got this great idea. Which, by the way, after 187 days of partying, if a great idea comes to you, sober up, think it through. All right, so he has this great idea. I've shown the people my wealth and power, thinks Xerxes. Now I need to show them my trophy wife. And so the Bible says that he wanted to, verse 11, display her beauty to all the people and the nobles. So king doesn't even go himself. He gets his servants to fetch her. And they go to get her. Imagine the humiliation involved. Imagine. I mean, the Bible doesn't describe what was going through in Vashti's head, but we can deduce based on her response. Okay, let me get this straight. You guys have been partying for 187 days, and you want me to come out and get up on the catwalk in front of this mob? No. I'm not going to do that. Thanks anyway. And then how does the king respond? This is, you know, King Xerxes. Oh, you're right, dear. That would be awkward. Is that how he responds? No, not at all. In fact, he responds, this is one of the reasons I'm convinced this is the Xerxes of history, because look how he responds. He responds like this. The king became furious and burned with anger. That sounds like Xerxes. In fact, if I did quick research. I looked up Wikipedia and to look up Xerxes, see if I could find some more about this guy. So hopefully it's accurate. According to them, you remember the bridge that Xerxes was building? Okay, didn't go so well at first. A storm comes through and knocks out this bridge. And guess what he does? The bridge gets destroyed by a storm. Building the bridge is just a bad idea anyway, but the bridge gets destroyed by a storm. And he gets furious and he burns with anger. And he has the bridge builders beheaded. And worse than that, not worse from a human law standpoint, but from a, this is crazy standpoint, he has the water whipped. Serious. He has the Hellespont whipped. Imagine you're the guy that has to go do this order. Okay, go whip the Hellespont. Okay, you want me to beat some rocks on the way too? I don't know. It just does not make sense. And Xerxes, he didn't just whip water when he lost his temper. Get this. In 480 BC, Xerxes engaged the Spartans, Sparta, in the Battle of Thermopylae, okay? Here's where how they betrayed or portrayed Xerxes and this Leonidas of Sparta in that movie. Well, the Spartans, they fought bravely, and Xerxes is sending his troops, and they're not breaking through. And according to history, Xerxes has his own people whipped because they're not getting through. So he whips water, he whips his own troops. He's got issues. And when the Persians, listen to this, when the Persians finally defeated the Spartans and their leader, this Leonidas, was dead, do you know what Xerxes had done to him? I don't know if this was in the movie or not, but generally, Persian leaders, when they came up against somebody who fought bravely against them, they honored that person. That's generally what they did. Well, Leonidas, man, he died in battle. Never has there been a person braver than him, 300 against all these thousands and thousands and thousands. Well, after he's dead, he's already dead. Leonidas is already dead. Xerxes has him decapitated. And then he takes the decapitated body and has it crucified. And this guy's got serious anger issues, and that plays in later on. Okay, back to the story. So Vashti, remember her? We were talking about her before. She won't come. So Xerxes pulls together a special meeting of his top leaders. See any irony there? You are the most powerful man on the planet, and you need to get your council together to figure out what to do for a domestic issue. This is crazy. And if there was ever need as to why ECC will seek to have women on our leadership board, let me offer exhibit A. Here is the wisdom of his council, okay? Here we go. Esther 1:16-20. Okay, so then this guy replies, one of his leaders, in the presence of the king and the nobles, Queen Vashti has done wrong, not only against the king, but against all the nobles and people of all the provinces of King Xerxes. For the queen's conduct will become known to all the women, and they will despise their husbands and say, King Xerxes commanded Queen Vashti to be brought before him, but she would not come. This very day, the Persian and Median women of the nobility who have heard, I can't even read this with a straight face, who have heard about the queen's conduct will respond to all the king's nobles in the same way. As if that's a problem. There will be no end of the disrespect and discord. Therefore, if it pleases the king, let him issue a royal decree and let it be written in the laws of Persia and Media, which cannot be repealed, that Vashti is to never again enter the presence of King Xerxes. And let the king give her royal position to someone else who's better than she. Then, when the king's edict is proclaimed, okay, get this, women, you're not going to say amen to this. Then, when the king's edict is proclaimed throughout all his vast realm, the women will respect their husbands from the least to the greatest. Yeah, that's going to happen. I mean, this is Xerxes, and this is his council. So Xerxes takes their advice, and then he goes off to war, which didn't go all that well for the Persians, which brings us to chapter 2. Esther, chapter 2, verse 1, if we can put it on the screen. Later, when King Xerxes' fury subsided, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what had been decreed about her. Now, this is not just later. This is much later. Do we have it ready with the timeline? All right, Jonathan, can we get the Vashti one up first? I'm a visual guy, so maybe this helps put perspective. I think this is important for the rest. So if you can put up this, here's the timeline. We got Queen Vashti. She's out about 484, 483 BC, okay? So this is what we just read. Thanks. All right, stay there. All right, can we get someone to take the middle one? Ryan's got it. All right, so now this is that battle with Sparta right here. This is what comes next. So this, she's out, they go off to war, and then, now, you got the next one there? All right, and then here is where we pick up with the story. Okay, this is after Vashti, after the battle, this is now where we pick up. So we got that? We're good? Okay, thanks, you guys. You can sit down. They're going, all right, our part's over. I can, what's that? You can keep that, yes. As you will covet, be covet. Yeah, anyway, all right, I want to keep moving. Okay, stick to the notes, right? I'm learning that lesson, I should say. Okay, so there's the timeline. Okay, so what do you do when this self-indulgent king has gone to battle, didn't go so well, had a wife, didn't go so well? What do you do to cheer this guy up? What do you do to cheer him up? Well, this time he didn't go to his cabinet. This is even worse. He goes to people who are probably his bodyguards. So he goes to a bunch of testosterone-filled guys, says, what do you think I should do? about this. And here's their advice. Oh, man. He says, their advice is, let's have every one of your 127 provinces have a beauty contest. All right? We'll take the number one hottie from every one of these. We'll parade them up in front of you. And they'll get beauty treatments for a whole year. And then the one that pleases you the most, she's your queen. Now, we're getting to know Xerxes a little bit. His response to this proposal should not surprise you. The advice appealed to the king, and he followed it. Now, it's hard to believe. I know in our civilized society, it is hard to believe that there was a time when a group of beautiful women would be assembled and then paraded in front of one bachelor. And this bachelor would be in a position to choose the one who pleased him the most and discard the rest. I know we can't even imagine that in our society. And I also know that in 21st century America, none of us can imagine an older guy leveraging his power and wealth and resources to entice a trophy wife. Can't imagine it, right? All right, well, all joking aside, I almost had to get the laughs in there because this next part is disturbing. It really gets dark. And I've never read this book as a dad before. Never like zeroed it in. As a dad of two girls. Man, this is disturbing stuff. We don't know the stories of all the girls. The Bible focuses on one. We know her as Esther. She had a Hebrew name, but we know her as Esther. And Esther was possibly derived from the Persian word for star. I love that, for star. So this precious little star that we start to read about, she was an orphan. I really can feel for this girl. She was an orphan who was taken in and cared for by her cousin, who now became her guardian, Mordecai. And the Bible says that Mordecai, he took her in as his own daughter when her father and mother had died. And this girl who was once taken in is now taken from. Look at the contrast in these verses. Mordecai had taken her as his own daughter, but now she's taken to the king's palace. Well, the Bible is God's living word. And when you start to engage the text, not just reading it, but like engage it, it starts to engage you. And this started to sink in. My heart went out to this girl. She comes from a people who were persecuted, who were exiled. She has no mom, no dad. She's beautiful and personable and smart. We're going to see that later. I mean, this girl could have had any guy she wanted, but she's taken. She's taken to the king. And this, again, this gets dark. If you ever, when people come up and they say, boy, the Bible, give them some grace. Because there is stuff like this in the Bible that is dark. It's dark. And I will do my best to tactfully word what happens. The most beautiful young virgins in the entire kingdom are taken from their lands. They're put in a position where even the winner doesn't win. They're taken from their homes, from any hope of a real marriage or any real family of their own. After a full year of beauty treatments, they'll be given one night with the king. They'll be stripped of their innocence. They will then become part of a harem, objects for the king to use at a future time, or objects to just be rejected and discarded. The women with perhaps the most potential in the kingdom. In verses 16 and 17, we read it's Esther's turn. She's taken to him, and he was more attracted. I mean, this just makes me sick to read it. This is the words. He was attracted to her more than the others. So he placed a crown on her head, proclaimed her queen, and gave a great banquet. He even proclaimed a holiday, handed out gifts. So this precious star is now the wife of King Xerxes, the same brutal king who had Leonidas beheaded and water whipped. And things are about to get worse. Enter Haman. Well, in chapter 3, we get introduced to this new guy. Xerxes, chief of staff. And it's interesting, there's this subtle literary thing that they do in the Bible. Chapter 2 ends with this Mordecai, Esther's guardian. He saves King Xerxes from an assassination plot. And it doesn't say anything about any reward for him. He's unrewarded. Saves the king, unrewarded. Well, then all of a sudden Haman appears, chapter 3, and it doesn't say that he did anything. And now he's elevated up to the chief of staff with no reason given. Well, Haman, he relishes this role. In fact, even the other officials in the court bow to him, for the king commanded it to be so, we read in chapter 3. But Esther's guardian, Mordecai, he won't bow. Even though King Xerxes, who faced the Spartans in battle, who whips his own men and disobedient bodies of water, even though King Xerxes decrees it, Mordecai won't bow. Won't bow. And all the other people are like, dude, you got to bow. I bet you didn't know dude was Persian. Day after day, Bible says, they warned Mordecai that he better bow, and he simply told them, I'm a Jew, dudes. And when that got back to Haman, he was enraged, and he began to plot not only to destroy Mordecai, we're going to kill all of these Jewish people in a single day, young and old, men and women, we're going to kill them all one day. Well, make no mistake, there's going to be annihilation. It's going to happen. Who's going to get annihilated? There is a way that seems right, the Bible says, but in the end it leads to death. And that is why it's so important that we listen to the right spirit. There's not just one spirit in play. We got to listen to the right one. And in this case, Haman listened to the wrong one. He sealed his own fate. Haman has now aligned himself against the father to the fatherless. He aligned himself against that. More so, Haman has aligned himself against God's purposes and promises. Do biblical details matter? Yes. In chapter 3, verse 7, we learn that Haman begins plotting the destruction of the Jews during the exact same month that the Jews are celebrating the Passover deliverance from Egypt. That's interesting. The future existence of God's chosen people and ultimately the appearance of the Redeemer Messiah, that's threatened by what Haman wants to do. Is God going to let that happen? Watch the spirits at work. Okay, we're going to start to speed things up. Esther chapter 4. Word reaches Mordecai that this is going to happen. So he and Esther have this fascinating exchange. Mordecai, he can't get to Esther directly, so he's passing these messages back and forth. And he passes this message. He goes, message, you got to go to the king's presence to beg for mercy, to plead with him for your people. And Esther's like, how? How can I do that? Look, here's what it says. Esther chapter 4, verses 10 through 11. If you're keeping mental score in your head of how long we're going to be here today, we're only going through chapter 7, okay? Here we go. Chapter 4, verses 10, and we fast forward from here. Okay, chapter 4, verses 10 through 11. Okay, so she instructs this messenger to say to Mordecai, you guys, or Mordecai, the king's officials and all the people of the royal provinces know you can't just go to the king. If you go, if you approach the king in the inner court without being summoned, the king has but one law, that they be put to death. Exception, if he puts out his royal scepter, you won't be killed. So she's going, I can't just go uninvited. It's been 30 days since I was asked. He could have me killed. He could have me killed. Imagine the pressure facing Esther. It does not seem to be wise to go to King Waterwhipper and say, you're doing a bad job. Especially when you got 126 other hotties waiting in the wings. This does not seem smart. But look how Mordecai responds. You guys, we need Mordecais in our lives. Because he doesn't just go, you're right. We got to find another way. I mean, look at him. He pushes back in a good and God-honoring way. Look at this. Verses 12 through 14. When Esther's words were reported to Mordecai, he sent back this answer. He said, do not think that because you're in the king's house, you alone of all the Jews will escape. For if you remain silent at this time, relief is going to come. And deliverance for the Jews, it's going to come from another place. But if you and your father's family, well, they're going to perish. And who knows but that you have come to royal position for such a time as this. Now, I tell you, for a book of the Bible that doesn't mention God by name, this is profound theological truth, isn't it? He's basically saying, hey, you know what? God is in control. And ultimately, God will deliver his people. But Esther, you have a role in this. You have a part to play. Perhaps you have come into royal position for such a time as this. And Esther replies with one of the most faith-filled, courage-laden responses in the entire Bible. And now that you know more about Xerxes, I hope you can see why this is a big deal. Okay, Esther, chapter 4, verses 15 through 17, read like this. Then Esther sent this reply to Mordecai. Go, gather together all the Jews who are in Susa. Fast for me. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. And I and my attendants will do this fast as you do. When it is done, I will go to the king. And even though it is against the law, and if I what? I perish I perish. And was there a good chance from her thought that she might perish? Absolutely. Now we're going to go to this response in a second. Leave it up on the screen here. But I don't want to gloss over verse 17, the last one. So Mordecai went away and did what? He actually carried out all of Esther's instructions. If you're wondering, hey, why don't I see more of God's activity in my life? Could it be that we're not carrying out the instructions? Like we say, oh, I'll pray about that, but we don't pray. Or we go to someone for wise counsel, they give us wise counsel, and then we don't hear and put into practice. I didn't want to miss that. Okay, well, Esther's response. Esther's words are as magnificent in their courage as Mordecai's were in their challenge. And as a side note, in a day when some Christian writers write that a woman's deepest aspiration is to become a beauty who is pursued and rescued by a man, let us not forget this example of a precious little star who rejects the stereotype of a beauty queen, who subverts the two most powerful men in the most powerful nation on earth, and who puts on a stunning display of courage and intelligence and rescues all the men in the story. Now you can amen if you want. All right. Well, you know, I was thinking about this. Leonidas and Esther would have been a better match. Don't you think? If I was in charge of MediterraneanSignals.com, I would hook those two up, not Xerxes. I don't know who I'd put Xerxes with. Maybe a mirror or something, a picture of himself. Okay. But here's my point. I want to go with this. This is a side note, but this might help. Some of you who've heard that movie 300 have seen it. Okay. Much is made, and rightfully so, of Leonidas' bravery. I mean, he stood against amazing odds. But he was trained that way from birth, wasn't he? He was trained to be a warrior. He was trained to have fear taken out of him. He was trained to fight. So it made sense that because of his training, he could respond that way. What about Esther? She is an orphan girl, thrust into this with no training. Other than training in godliness. What kind of spirit is at work in that woman? And what kind of courage did she show? I think she shows more bravery than Leonidas. This is huge. This is huge. Which, we're on a side note anyway, so let me pause to ask this question while we're there. What spirit is at work in you? Is it the spirit that we see in Haman, that we see in Xerxes, the one that keeps leading you towards the easy way out, leading you towards what is immediate gratification, leading towards what will make you look good? Is it that spirit, or is it a spirit that takes you down the narrow road towards justice, compassion, self-sacrifice? And I'll answer that question for you, because the answer is both. Both of those spirits are at work at both of all of us all the time. So then the question becomes, which spirit are you going to submit to, and which one are you going to resist? Because it makes all the difference. Okay, back to the drama. All right, this really gets interesting. Okay, Esther chapter 5, verses 1 through 4. On the third day, Esther, she does it. She puts on her royal robe. She stood in the inner court of the palace in front of the king's hall. The king was sitting on the royal throne. Imagine, heart's got to be pounding, facing the entrance. When he saw Queen Esther standing in the court, he was pleased. God gave her favor. He held out the gold scepter that was in his hand, and Esther came up and touched it. So Esther comes, heart pounding into the presence of the king. King extends the scepter. But Esther doesn't only come with courage, she comes with wisdom. I believe this fast gave her the plan that was spirit-inspired and spirit-empowered. So they come. She invites the king to a banquet. This king has never turned down a banquet in his life. All right. So he says yes. She invites not just the king, but Haman as well. She gets the two a little liquored up. It's there, verse 6. And then the king asks, hey, what's your request, Esther? Up to half my kingdom, I'll grant it. And look at her wise reply. Esther 5, 7 through 8. If the king regards me with favor, if it pleases the king to grant my petition, these are brilliant words, and fulfill my request, let the king and Haman come tomorrow to a banquet. I will prepare for them. Then I will answer the king's question. Okay, here's what happens next. You can kind of read along. Just click it as you're reading. I'm going to keep moving. So Haman, you can just, when you think they've read to the next, just go ahead and click it. All right. So Haman is just pumped. He's like, I'm going to the most exclusive banquet in the world. I'm the only one getting asked to this. I am thrilled. Oh, there's Mordecai. And he's not bowing. Or actually this time, instead of not bowing, which he didn't do last time. Now he's not rising in respect. So he's furious. He goes back and he's like, that Mordecai makes me so mad. Here I am. Then he goes and boasts to everybody. He's like, I got this and that and the other thing. And I'm all about this and that. But that Mordecai. So he's furious. All right. And his friends are not wise counsel. He doesn't have a lot of Mordecais in his life. They're like, well, gee, just get a 75-foot thing and impale him on it. Haman's like, good idea. Let's do that. So now he's happy again. Okay? Now, meanwhile, here we go. So we're going to summarize. Quick side note again. Haman needs to learn to listen, not just to the Spirit of God, but to other people who God is speaking to. Esther did. Esther had a Mordecai in her life. And Mordecai told her something that was not easy to hear, something that could have cost her her life. But did she listen? Yes. Mordecai should have listened to the only guy who's not kissing up, only guy in the kingdom who's not kissing up to Haman. If he would have just listened to Mordecai, things could have turned out different. Mordecais are not a lot of fun at parties, but we need them in our lives. Okay, now 6 and 7, here we go. Meanwhile, as Haman is responding to one spirit, the other spirit is at work behind the scenes. Xerxes can't sleep, so he asks his servants to read to him from the chronicles that record his reign. Isn't that Xerxes ask? Bring me that book about me. It's Xerxes. He would have been a big fan of MySpace, although he would only read his own space. All right, so it just so happens that they read the part where Mordecai saves him from an assassination plot. And it just so happens that an egocentric king asks, have we honored this guy yet? And it just so happens the people knew the answer, which was no. And it just so happens that Haman comes in right then. Look at this. This is worth reading. All right. Haman, or Esther chapter 6, verses 6 through 10 says, when Haman entered, the king asked him, what should be done for the man that the king delights to honor? Haman, he thought to himself, who is there that the king would rather honor than me? So he answered the king, wink, wink, nod, nod, for the man who the king delights to honor, have him bring a royal robe that the king has worn and a horse that the king has ridden, the one with the royal crest placed on its head. And then let the robe and horse be entrusted to one of the king's most noble princes. Let them robe the man the king delights to honor and lead him on the horse through the city streets, proclaiming before him, this is what is done for the man the king delights to honor. And the king says, huh, that's good. Haman, you pull the horse. Get Mordecai to ride it. Imagine that moment. It is all over from there. Haman goes home after pulling Mordecai around, and he's like, you would not believe the day I just had. And he gets yanked out for the second banquet. And we read Esther 7, 1 through 10. So the king and Haman went to Queen Esther's banquet. And as they were drinking wine on the second day, the king again asked, Queen Esther, what's your petition? It will be given to you. What is your request? Even up to half the kingdom, it will be granted. Then Queen Esther answered, if I have found favor with you, your majesty, and if it pleases you, grant me my life. This is my petition. And spare my people. This is my request. Great wordplay there. And I and my people, For I and my people have been sold to be destroyed, killed, annihilated. If we had been merely sold as male and female slaves, I would have been kept quiet because no such distress would justify disturbing the king. King Xerxes asked Queen Esther, who is he? Where is he? The man who dared do such a thing. Esther said, remember that guy that pulled the horse? That's the one. Adversary and enemy, this vile Haman. Then Haman was terrified before the king and queen. The king got up in rage and left the wine. That's a first. And went out to the garden. I think that's the first time in the scriptures. But Haman, realizing what the king had already decided his fate, he stayed behind. Picture this. Mordecai, he got mad at Mordecai for not bowing. Now he is bowing to Queen Esther saying, grant me my life. And then the king comes in. He's like, what are you doing to my queen? You're molesting her. I mean, it's, wow. Wow. And Haman's annihilated. Mordecai gets Haman's job. And Esther gets to compose the new law that not only saves the Jews, but gives them authority to gain victory over their enemies. And remember, this is history. One of the sources I looked at said they think they found Mordecai's name on a tablet as far away as Babylon. This happened. How does history get turned upside down like this? How is it that of all the women in the empire, an orphaned Jewish girl becomes queen? How is it that of all the people in the empire, her cousin and guardian is the one who saves the king from an assassination plot? How is it that the king should have insomnia on the very night that Haman built the gallows? How is it that of all the chronicles that could have been read to the king that night, they read the one featuring Mordecai? How is it that the scheming murderer Haman is humbled in the act that he intended to exalt himself by and becomes the victim of his own schemes? How is it that Mordecai, his intended victim, becomes his replacement? How did the people who marked the Jews for destruction became themselves destroyed, ironically, by the decree of the same young Jewish orphan girl who is now writing state policy? How is it, by the end of the book, that an exiled people becomes so favored that others commit themselves to this God of Israel? The book of Esther, in this book, I'm not going to like, okay, here's all the punchline, because I think it almost speaks for itself. Let me just say these closing words. There are unseen spirits, aren't there? They were directing Haman, directing Xerxes. Esther could have bowed to them. Mordecai could have. But there's this other spirit, the spirit of God, that can even in our choices, somehow mysteriously, in our free choices, can bring about God's sovereign plan. Why would we not want to channel that spirit? So let me pray for us to do that as individuals and for an organization. Then I just got some quick wrap-up things as we go out.